Everyone has a story. How they got here, where they met along the way, the choices they made, the dreams they are chasing. Welcome to Anthologies of Hope. Welcome back to Anthologies of Hope this week. As always, I'm your host, Rick Osowski, and I am not a mental health professional in any way, simply a mental health advocate with a passion for storytelling. I hope you've had some fun last week with our Bonus Conversations Cafe episode titled The Hero in You, and had more than a few laughs with a special guest for that event, Marty DeRosa. We definitely had a blast at a live event, and I think that comes across in this season's first bonus episode. We will have a handful more bonus episodes covering future Conversations Cafe events, as well as some more ad hoc events like some of our on-site interview activities this past weekend at C2E2. Turning our attention back to our traditional interviews, we are in the thick of season two, and we will continue bringing you episodes every week for another 10 or so weeks with members of the HeartCamp family. If you're not familiar with HeartCamp, we dive deep into the ins and outs of it in our first two episodes of season one. But as a quick refresher, HeartCamp is the brainchild of Jamie Torkowski and a two-day workshop focusing on authenticity, writing, bringing your heart to work, and mental health. For more info on HeartCamp, including upcoming dates like May 4th and 5th in Melbourne, Florida, you can check out heartcampwithjamie.com for details. This week, our episode brings us Kim's story, and it is arguably the most powerful story we've been empowered to share on Anthologies of Hope so far. I mentioned early on in the interview that excited is an awkward way to phrase the feeling around the ability to help share Kim's story. I think the more appropriate term would be grateful. Through Kim's mental health journey and battling through multiple bouts of major depressive disorder, as well as other internal and external triggers, we see a robust toolbox that Kim has developed over the course of that journey, from a fake it till you make it game face, to therapy and counseling, to the use of more integrated health practices like an intensive outpatient program, more commonly known as an IOP, which you'll hear about in more upcoming interviews as well. I will be forever grateful that Kim chose to share her story with us and you, our listeners. Kim's story is a powerful one and a constant reminder that it is completely okay not to be okay, as well as the fact that being in crisis does not mean you are broken. There are plenty of examples throughout our interview where these sentiments are very, very relevant. Moving on to our season two playlist, which will be available at anthologiesofhope.com/playlist, you will still be able to find our old season one playlist under our user account on Spotify, as well as anthologiesofhope.com/playlist-season-1. Tying into my selection for last week's episode and the metaphor of the mythical phoenix being reborn from the fiery ash, that is very appropriate for our discussion with Kim this week as well. However, sometimes Spotify knows us better than we know ourselves, which is scary. I hadn't heard my selection for this week until recently when I was letting Spotify play on shuffle based on our season one playlist. At some point, the song The Resolution by Jack's Mannequin came up, and one lyric kept circling in my head over and over again. I need a light in the darkness as I search for the resolution. I don't know if we'll have an episode where this lyric would ever be more appropriate. Maybe sometimes we don't need answers. We don't need things to be fixed. We need to see the light to simply know that those things exist. Each week, we'd like to remind you that if you're in a time of crisis, we'll be covering a range of potentially difficult topics. Please use this as a warning to seek help and come back to listen once you are in a more positive season. If you are in need of help, an abundance of international resources can be found on the Find Help pages from To Write Love in Our Arms and Hope for the Day. To Write Love in Our Arms can be found at twloha.com/find-help, and Hope for the Day can be found at hftd.org/find-help. As always, you can find us at anthologiesofhope.com, on Facebook and Instagram as Anthologies of Hope, on Twitter as Anthologies Pod, or email us directly at anthologiesofhope, all one word, no punctuation, @gmail.com. Like, subscribe, and rate us on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and Google Podcasts. Without any further delay, Kim, you have my gratitude, my grace, and my thanks. Anthologies of Hope, Season 2, Episode 4.
Hi, my name is Kim, and I guess I'm here today to share my story with you all.
Based on some of the prep that we've had and some of the conversation that we've had, this is one I'm very excited is a weird word. I guess looking forward to is a better, more appropriate term to talk through your story and seeing some of or having seen what some of what we're going to talk about. It's very reminiscent of a lot of other stories on anthologies of hope, but also one I'm very thankful, you know, you're jumping into to help break the stigma and help share that exact journey to kind of bring out some of the other folks that may be experiencing something similar and to fight that stigma and know that hope is real, help is out there, and that there are people that can help bring the story to light. So, I mean, without any further ado, why don't we jump into the beginning of your story and go right into it?
All right. So as a kid, similar to lots of people, I came from a household that there was a lot of abuse. My father's an alcoholic. He was verbally abusive, emotionally abusive to us. My mom was a master manipulator, and so she did a lot of messed up things with us kids as well. And basically, we were taught to be little adults by the time we were 5 or 6 years old and self-sufficient in everything we did. So kind of a bizarre, not a lot of love in the household, things like that.
How many siblings did you have?
I have 3 siblings, all older than me. I'm the only girl. And so there were some differences in how I was treated being the youngest and the only girl as far as some of the abuse that went on. My father was definitely a male chauvinist, and so sometimes I bore the brunt of some things. Also, later on, it'll come into play, but I kind of became an only child after my siblings had moved out of the house, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden I'm an only child and don't really know what to do with that, but I'm the primary target at that point. So I was a kind of a loner as a kid in a lot of ways as far as truly connecting with people. You know, I had friends in the neighborhood I played with and things like that, but I didn't ever share what happened in our household. It was kind of brainwashed for us that what happens behind closed doors stays behind closed doors. You don't talk about that stuff. So even my best friend from childhood, who knew lots about me, didn't know about the abuse that went on in my household. So I lived with that on my own. I was the one who witnessed my dad try to hit my mom at one point and ran in the house to one of my siblings and asked, you know, screaming for help. And he came down, and the first thing he did is looked at me and said, "Dad did not try to hit mom." So not only was there a lot of what happens behind closed doors stays behind closed doors, there was a lot of denial in my household. And so I was very isolated because I didn't have that same denial gene that my siblings seemed to have. And that made it so I didn't really have anyone to talk to at all. Since I couldn't talk outside the house, I couldn't really talk to my siblings. It was a tough place as a, you know, 10-year-old kid to deal with the fact that your dad just tried to hit your mom and you can't say anything anywhere.
Yeah, especially at that time when you're starting to understand right and wrong and assert yourself and things like that. And as you said, being lonely, and just that reinforced all of the negative stuff there. So that was, I'm very sorry for that, because that's the point where you should be growing into yourself and not kind of just retreating into yourself.
Yeah, and at times I thought I was crazy. Maybe I was wrong. All these adults, all these older people that me keep telling me I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. So I was constantly questioning, but I knew what I saw. And true, it was through a 10-year-old's perspective. There may have been more to the story as far as my parents were concerned, if they were honest about it. But my perspective was still real regardless.
Yep.
So I did a lot of finagling and jockeying. I didn't really want to have any physical contact with my dad after that. And so I did a lot of trying to find ways to avoid that. And it took me several weeks to figure out how to get rid of the goodnight hug and that kind of stuff. And there was a lot of guilt for hurting feelings and things like that. So I was often sort of guilt-ridden just for trying to survive. So that was the basis for a lot of this stuff. When I was 15 is when I sort of became that only child. We moved and I lost my support network that I had. Even though they didn't know the story, there were still people that I had gotten to be really good friends with who I could just go hang out with and be with and that stuff. So
they can still support you without having to, you essentially brain dump or, like you said, tell them the whole story, but they're still supporting you more than they knew.
Yeah, exactly. And so things escalated a lot. You know, my dad wasn't happy with his new job and things like that. So the alcoholism and the abuse continued to escalate. My mom had manipulated me into being her protector. So I'm now the one going toe to toe with my dad all the time. Not really sure what mom does that to her 15-year-old kid, but mine did. And so it was fun times, let me tell you. But that's when sort of the depression set in. I had no idea really what depression was, so I didn't understand what was happening to me.
Yep.
I already was incredibly introverted to begin with. I'm an INTJ. My introversion is off the scales. So some of that at some time seemed like that's what it was, not depression and things like that. So I went from 15 until I was 23 of just sort of struggling with this on my own and, you know, in a major depressive disorder period that ended up lasting about a decade. I was a pretty miserable young adult. I had always resorted to helping other people.
Yep.
And that was my way of trying to forget my own shit and deal with theirs instead and get some satisfaction and sense of worth out of helping others. So, you know, college was an interesting thing. Obviously, there's a few more resources. Took enough psychology classes. I now sort of understand more what's happening to me as I get older, that I am struggling with depression and suicidal thoughts and at the time, self-injury. You know, I had no idea that was even a thing. I just happened to see a razor blade on a coffee table and was talking to a friend and started carving a soccer ball into my hand. And then sort of liked how that felt and liked how that got my mind to stop racing and all of those things. So I continued to cut, although most of those scars have gone away by now. So I wasn't doing anything particularly deep or whatnot at that time. In fact, I used to use my arm as my doodling pad. So I'd draw pictures on myself with a razor blade.
Oh, okay.
So, and they were all hidden enough that I didn't get asked about it. The soccer ball in my hand, my parents saw it and they were like, oh, that's cute. I mean, nobody had any idea what I'd really done and what it really meant in a bigger sense. So in college, my suicidal thoughts started to really kick in and it got to a point where, you know, it was an every night thing and I didn't know how to make it stop. I didn't know how to make my mind stop racing. You know, I wouldn't sleep all night. I'd try to go to class when I could, although I missed an awful lot of class. So I either read the books or I went to class, one or the other, is how I got through college.
Okay.
You know, I think I still graduated with like a 3.8. So I'm just lucky in that school came easy to me. And so, but I guess the only reason I point that out is I was still being a successful college student as far as everyone else saw.
Yeah, you're still wearing that mask.
Yeah,
exactly.
I call it my game face.
Okay. But yeah, that's a good term for it.
And I feel like I've perfected it for myself over the years. But I was going to school to be a teacher, and I was, during my student teaching, I was teaching for two different teachers in the same school, and they felt their curriculum was the same, and it really wasn't, and it was kind of a nightmare. I got along really well with one of them, and the other one I did not get along with at all. And, I mean, to her credit, she sensed something was going on. She just went about it in a horrible way to try to get me to open up to her. She was just very much like, something's wrong with you and I don't understand why you won't tell me what it is. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, 'cause I don't trust you. it's pretty simple. And so things kind of came to a head after the third quarter of high school and we had a meeting and I finally said, look, I'm done. I'm not going to put up with you belittling me all the time and telling me how much I have this problem that I won't talk to you about. And that's becoming a hindrance. And I don't want to work with you anymore. So midway through my semester, I quit my student teaching and had no clue if I'd just thrown away a semester's worth of tuition and if I was going to graduate now and all this stuff. And so I finally decided that, you know, I would go to the counseling center on campus. You know, I didn't want to use my dad's insurance prior to that because what am I supposed to say? Dad, yeah, I need to go to counseling because you're an alcoholic.
Exactly.
And abusive and can I have your insurance card, please? Thanks.
Obviously, that wouldn't end up real well, and that's something that we've got to try to, you know, help with the system currently, because that's, I'm sure a lot of people are in that situation now. And it's actually a good thing that I've come into contact with a couple of organizations for mental health and even veterans organizations for mental health, that they don't have the need to bill insurance or contact insurance at all. So that ends up helping that to get the ball rolling and then eventually, you know, stabilize that a little bit later on. It's a bad situation to be in because you're backed into a corner that way where you're not going to go hat in hand to go back and into the lion's den, for lack of a better term, to ask for help for all the things that they put you through. So yeah, that's an unfortunate situation to be in.
Yeah. And I didn't know where else to go. I mean, I had the name of a counselor, but I couldn't afford to pay her. So it was like, and I guess I wasn't wise enough at that point to even call her to see if there were options. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd never dealt with any of this stuff. My mom used to make our doctor's appointments, not us, you know, whatever. Yep. So I went to the counseling center on campus and they made me fill out a little form, and the guy calls me in and goes, "Wow, you're really suicidal." And I said, "Yeah, I am." And he's like, "All right, well, let's see if we can get you some help." And at the time they could only do 6 sessions with me. It was a state school and that's the max they could do. So when I met with the actual counselor, she was awesome. And she was just like, "Look, you don't strike me as a group therapy person." And I'm like, "What gave you that idea?" And she's like, it's going to take more than 6 sessions. It's not that you're not fixable, but you got a lot of stuff going on." And so she said, "Let's focus on helping you find a counselor that can give you longer term support and care." And so she gave me a lot of resources. She gave me a lot of information about, you know, interviewing a counselor before going to them and trying to get a sense of if there was any connection there over the phone before you spent the money on the appointment. And, you know, sort of said, if a counselor's not willing to do that, then that's not a counselor you want to go see. And just all sorts of advice. In fact, I still have the sheet of paper of all the notes of how to find a counselor that I've actually given to many people over the years.
Yeah, I can imagine that being very helpful.
Yeah, because I had no idea. I would have just looked in the yellow pages. Yes, that's how old I am. And yes, that's how long ago this was.
Unfortunately, that's the way a number of folks hear. And I mean, it's so different now. I mean, that's kind of what Google is, where Google's just a number of folks have said that in other interviews we've done, where it's just gone and do counseling or mental health counseling near X, wherever they happen to live, or Christian counseling near X or something like that. And so we're slowly getting there, or again, it ends up being something where the resources that folks have aren't as knowledgeable, but that's again always the first place you go to kind of think about it, is just the mass index of where everything that you would ever want to find is. You need a plumber, go to the yellow pages /Google. Need this, do that. Yep. And so it's very much very similar. And so you would think that we'd have more advertised, a lot more constructive ways of doing that today, which thankfully we do and are kind of getting there. But again, you know, back 10 years ago, before smartphones, 10 years before that, before the, you know, the proliferation of the internet, none of those resources existed. And many folks are still dealing with many of the issues there that would never have had access to resources of that capacity. So just kind of filling that out and having the experience of going down the list of the, you know, the yellow pages results is a hard one to kind of jump through when you're dealing with those problems to begin with.
Yeah, the other really cool thing she told me is, like, I think there was a Lutheran counseling center that she had given me the number for, and she said, "Look, don't be afraid of Christian-based counseling. Like, they will typically, if you're a Christian and would like to incorporate that into your counseling, they will. But if you're not a Christian and don't want to incorporate that, they won't." And so she said, just because it might have a religious affiliation doesn't necessarily mean it needs to match your beliefs. Your individual counselor should be able to adjust and adapt according to what you would like, which is something I never, you know, I saw it and was like, "Well, that won't work."
Yeah, it's an immediate turn off type thing.
But I've been to several religious-based counseling organizations when I wasn't a Christian, so, and have never had a problem with keeping that out of my counseling if that's what I chose. So
that's good to hear.
Yeah,
And that kind of is one where going back to your checklist or your interview questions for that person, where that ends up being something that ends up defining a good relationship between patient and clinician initially, so that you are finding that right fit as opposed to just jamming it in or just, trying to make it work when it's just actually more harm than good in the long run type thing.
So I ended up finding a counselor and was, still very reluctant to that after being sort of brainwashed of you don't share your stuff outside the house and some of that stuff. So it took me a long time to establish enough trust with this guy, and he's a great guy. He was a very gentle person, was very patient, all that kind of stuff, asked good questions to try to get me to talk. And but anytime things got emotional for me, I would tend to shut down. And it took me probably 12 of the 18 months that I saw him to build up enough trust to let the emotions out. And so I've sort of learned from that myself that, opening up sooner rather than later will get me the help I need sooner rather than later. So, but I did a lot of learning about myself, learning about counseling. I did a lot of writing back then, which I found helpful to try to express my emotions and get things out. And after seeing him for about 18 months, I was moving away to a different town, and we were kind of at a point where I had learned enough to interact with my family and, once or twice a year for 2 or 3 days kind of thing, and survive that without that being this huge ordeal. And that seemed like a huge victory at the time.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of growth there.
Yeah, so that was kind of the first round. I still felt for a long time like I was treading water and still not quite swimming to shore and living my life, but continued to work on my stuff on my own and eventually kind of got through that. But that, like I said, that bout of major depression lasted about a decade from 15 to 25, and it was a rough go for sure. But I guess learning that much in that period of time has been invaluable since then, because I still use some of the things I learned back then today. So that was kind of the deal there.
Yeah, and it's great that you're still looking back now, recognizing some of those resources and some of the discussions you had during that time, and the ability to use some of the interview techniques for mental health professionals and things like that. And the one key you mentioned there, as far as it felt like treading water, that's a conversation that both on some of the other episodes that we've done here, as well as many of the conversations that we have, in the real world, that's a concept that folks often feel like, and that's not one that is unordinary to have, because it's something where, again, just as going into, or the connotation of, Christian counseling, just as we just talked about, or just looking up a counselor in whatever index you want, and then finding one, going there and be like, oh, I'm cured. Like, that's the conception, or a lot of the not necessarily stigma doesn't really apply there, but that's just kind of the one of the stories that we're told. But as a lot of the mental health counseling step of it is, that's a lot of the long-term treatment of it. So at the same time, it may be something like treading water just to get through the day-to-day stuff, but you're slowly, actively working on any of the mental health challenges that you're working through, and slowly progressing. It's not something where you're just fixing it overnight, because if you break your arm, you go to the hospital, putting on the cast doesn't heal your arm. It's the time afterwards that heals your arm, something like that. So working through that and trying to stabilize while working through a lot of the therapy sessions and doing the work may feel like treading water. But to the alternative, when looking at, as you mentioned, some of your self-injury and the suicidal thoughts, the alternative is nothing or non-existent. So the fact that you're still there and still treading water and, making small steps, that's still a win and a success towards your overall mental health and overall health journey.
Yeah, and I think the other distinction I would make between sort of my first round of major depression and that lasted forever and my second round is that back when you're 15 and in high school and that stuff, nobody pays attention. So I didn't have to develop my game face yet. I didn't talk in high school. And I had one teacher once in a while who would comment of, are you ever going to talk in my class?
Yeah.
I don't know. If you call on me, I'll answer, but no, I'm not going to raise my hand. You know, so I said two things in his class in an entire year, you know, so I just flew under the radar. Like, school counselors didn't catch on. Nobody seemed to notice. I was just invisible. That didn't necessarily help my depression, but the game face piece that I've had to add later is incredibly exhausting. And so there's times today where I'm like, wow, I wish I could go back and just not talk all day to people.
Exactly.
Like, that would be so nice. But my job doesn't work that way.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there aren't many jobs that you can get away with without interacting with anyone. So having that on sometimes is unfortunately necessary there.
Yeah, it is. It is.
Now, in that context of putting on your game face and not wanting to interact with as many people as possible, there were some transitions in your story as far as trying to spread the word around mental health, breaking the stigma around mental health treatment and some of that. So why don't we jump into potentially how you got engaged with Right Love in Our Arms at that time, sharing some of your initial story and then the communication around that.
Yeah, so I sort of stumbled across To Write Love on Our Arms on a t-shirt on a website that was before To Write Love on Our Arms really had a website. I was not a MySpacer. I already mentioned a Yellow Pages, so yeah, just, I wasn't quite in the right generation for that. But I did find more information, you know, Googling about To Write Love on Our Arms, about what it was and what the initial story was and things like that, and was like, wow, this is really cool. Like, I so wish this had existed when I was 15. Like, would have been such a huge resource to me. So I've been a big supporter ever since then. In 2008, I had sort of a health scare, and out of that came sort of a couple of different messages, and one of them was sharing my story. And it's a lot easier to share your story when you're not in the midst of crisis, but I've learned to do it even in the middle of it all. Mm-hmm. And I was at a photography workshop. Photography is one of my hobbies and one of my escapes. And we were at dinner, and somebody said something just very ignorant about depression and suicide and things like that. And so I started sharing my story. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in a polite way, not to call them out of being ignorant, but just to say, hey, well, you know, I actually deal with all of that. And they're like, what do you mean? I'm like, what do you mean? What do you mean? Mm-hmm. And so I started sharing my story, and ended up with three or four people at the table in tears about it, just feeling bad that they had no idea that people went through things like this, you know? And of course I'm thinking, how do you not know that? Because I know there's lots of people, my story isn't unique.
Yeah. Unfortunately.
I've always understood that, but it had such an impact on them. And, you know, one of them's like, I think that's what's going on with my niece. And, you know, and I've always offered to, you know, you want to give them my name and number, I'm happy to talk to them or whatever. And, you know, I coach soccer with a lot of kids and could pick out the kids who are struggling with stuff. And those are usually the kids I connected with. I didn't connect with the straight A students who were jocks like I was. I usually connected to the messed up kids, so to speak, you know, and became support for that. And just sharing my story started to educate people, for one. It started to help some people realize that, yes, they likely know others who are going through something similar, and trying to help them with, you know, some education around that, what they might be able to do to help. So that's been a big thing for me since 2008, is just continuing to share my story where I can. I figure it can't hurt, and I shouldn't be ashamed of it. So it's been good for me to open up about it and, you know, get rid of whatever guilt and shame I had about it. And it's also, I think, reached a lot of people. So nothing to the degree of Troy Love on our arms, but in my little world, it's been helpful for some folks and helping them understand. And, you know, I have a couple of friends here who are trying to be part of my support community who are like, I don't understand what you're going through. Like, I've just never experienced anything like that. Will you help me understand? And, you know, which is pretty huge for somebody to truly want to get it.
To jump in and truly honestly help.
So, yeah, so I've been trying to do that and trying to find other ways. You know, I've done the Try Love on Our Arms 10K and the Run For It. And I've posted videos on that, you know, trying to help break the stigma. You know, I've pushed my comfort zones. And, you know, my last boss, I finally told about it after one of the runs because it was 15 inches of snow here during the run. And he's like... You actually went and ran. I'm like, yeah, I did. He's like, why? Like, that's dumb. And I'm like, well, okay, I'll tell you why. Because this is the organization and this is what it's about. Mm-hmm. And I deal with these things right now on a daily basis. And yes, you'd never know it because I've perfected my game face and I'm very good at hiding it. But yeah, that's my world when I leave work. And so it's important to me. So I got all these people to donate money. I needed to do the run. That's kind of my deal there. And I don't know, I met Jamie at one point talking at college here in Colorado and was like, how does someone work for To Write Love on Our Arms? And he said, watch for the postings. But, you know, after having seeing their offices now and things like that. Yeah. It's not this big company or something. It's a mom and pop shop doing great things. So it's pretty amazing, but I'd love to find ways to do more to help break the stigma of mental health and to help provide information and resources to people.
Well, so. I think there's two things there that you said that are very important. And just the fact that you started sharing your story and the term that I like to use is snowballing, where you shared your story once, twice, and then other folks kind of start to dig into that and then understand that there are more people that are going through this. And then, like you said, at dinner, somebody said, oh, my niece may be dealing with something similar and XYZ, because it's very similar to the conversations that I have where just posting and sharing on social media, I have friends, coworkers, friends of friends reaching out, and then other people start sharing their stuff just based off of simple, like resharing a post on depression or anxiety or self-injury and things like that. And so the fact that it is, you don't have to have a massive nationwide marketing push behind you. So it's something where just similar to you just sharing your story will help, you know, X number of people have the confidence to start sharing their own story or being even just more knowledgeable of people that may need to share some of that with them and look for the warning signs and look for some of the issues that folks may be dealing with. And then kind of the fact where you said the size of Trite Love in Our Arms being a very much a mom and pop shop as far as compared to many of the other larger organizations that have larger brick and mortar presences or, you know, multiple regional offices and things like that. But it is something where that goes to the power of storytelling through the Trite Love in Our Arms space and a couple similar organizations that are small, but the power of the stories goes to show that the ability to share those stories goes a lot longer than the amount of stories needing to be shared type thing. So it's keep staying there, keep sharing those stories, and then those snowballs start to build up and pick momentum. And then eventually we're dealing with a pretty big element of the movement and having folks know that they can pick up and jump in whenever they're comfortable and able to. You've mentioned a couple of times that you've had your first bout with depression and some of those mental health challenges. So that would allude to a second round there. So during the kind of time you went from sharing your story to, and even you just mentioned previously, it's a lot easier to share your story when you're not in crisis. That would allude to a second round there, as well as then how did that affect your sharing the story and going from there and kind of what you needed to do to keep yourself stable while still progressing through some of that?
I do refer to it as my second round of major depression. Certainly between the two rounds, there's been times of depression, but it's always been stuff that lasted a month or two that I could kind of keep under control and never got to the self-harm or suicidal thought point or things like that. But I've definitely had times where I'm like, maybe it's time to find a counselor again and whatnot in between those two bouts of major depression. But my second round, the trigger for it was dealing with my dad's end of life.
Okay.
I was his primary advocate. We had moved my parents out to Colorado. And so here I am faced with dealing with this person who I don't care for. I don't want to touch. I have all these negative feelings towards who's now just this feeble old man. Mm-hmm. And I had a lot of physical contact with him that I didn't anticipate, given that he was in an assisted living facility and initially and then in the hospital. But the physical contact was a huge trigger for me. And I kind of lived in denial for about a year that, nope, it's fine, it's fine, it's fine. I don't need to get help. I'm not there yet and whatnot. But I should have gone much sooner than I did.
Yep.
And I was back to self-harming and dealing with suicidal thoughts, and my means of self-harming was still sometimes a razor blade, but I also had other means that were even more destructive to my body. And so, you know, I have a lot more scars that I don't think will go away this time. That sometimes is hard for other people, I guess. And there's times where I get self-conscious of it.
Mm-hmm.
As well, but they're part of my story is how I look at it at this point. So,
and that's the best way to look at it.
It's one more entry into sharing my story. So started going to counseling sort of a year into that. At some point, we decided that I really needed to go on meds. So I had to find a psychiatrist. And in Denver, finding counselors and psychiatrists is next to impossible.
Interesting.
Like, I had called 15 counselors before I finally found someone who was even taking new patients. So I didn't have really the luxury of going, oh, cool, I'm going to interview this person because he's really my only choice. And similar things with psychiatrists.
Now, so up to this point, during your first bout, were you on meds, or did you have that conversation about meds up to that point?
We had the conversation about meds in the first round. I refused.
Okay.
I really wanted to try to get through this on my own. I didn't want the help of meds to get there. Since then, I've, you know, learned a lot more about it. And I still don't love being on meds by any means, but people have proven to me that there's a chemical component involved in my depression.
Okay.
And so I've been pretty open to trying stuff. I've got a great psychiatrist who actually gives me a voice in what we do. So it's not just all him dictating everything. He usually tosses out a few options and asks me what I think would be best. And if he has a different opinion, he'll tell me that too. And we work it out.
That's great.
Yeah, it is. So I'm not sure that's how it always is. So, and I've done the dumb thing, and I've gone off my meds cold turkey a couple of times, and never understood why people would do that before, and now I do.
I think that's about as common as as common an occurrence for folks who are on meds of some sort in this space, as you mentioned about the initial refusal to go on meds. So it ends up being something where if you don't have someone who is as receptive and adaptive as the person you're working with, it's something where you're the one there taking the meds every day. So it feels like you need to make the change that way. And you feel like, again, even in the context of working with someone, there's still another stigma associated with that of trying to work out your own meds. And it becomes, you know, you're fighting yourself at that point. So that's completely understandable too.
Yep. I went to that counselor for a while, lost his trust at one point and changed counselors partway through this. I have a counselor now that I'm much more comfortable with and that I trust wholeheartedly. And we had a couple of times where we got to the conversation with how suicidal I was and whatnot of if you needed to call an ambulance and have me admitted, and got through the 1 week of that. And then I saw him the following week, and there was really just no no denying that that something needed to happen. So he actually made a deal that if I would agree to go get an assessment on my own, that he wouldn't call the ambulance and make me go through that path. He said sometimes that's more detrimental than helpful mm-hmm. for some people. And I don't think you deal real well with that. And I'm like, nope, I can tell you right now I wouldn't.
Yeah.
So I called that day and went in for an assessment and voluntarily admitted myself, and something I never thought would happen. I never thought I'd end up in a behavioral hospital, and had the typical reaction, as many people have that I've talked to, that, you know, when I got up the next morning, by the time I got up to the floor, it was late. Yeah, I'm looking around at these people going, I don't belong here. Mm-hmm. Like, these people are whacked. I don't belong here. And you come to realize pretty quickly that, no, you're all pretty much the same. The details are different, but you're all there for the same kind of reasons. And so it was a great experience from the standpoint of it kept me safe for a week. The rest of it, no, I had a horrible psychiatrist there who wouldn't discharge me. I had two different social workers. The one social worker finally was like, are you ready to go home? I'm like, yeah, but you got to get the psychiatrist to sign off on it. He's like, well, why won't you? And I'm like, you go find out. Yeah. You won't tell me. And, you know, so we have a lot of work to do there.
Yeah, and that's unfortunate and surprising. Society. Based off of you saying that was a behavioral hospital that you did the voluntary admission to. And so that's even more surprising because of a number of other shared experiences through friends. And then even some of the ones I've been personally connected to, those tend to be a little bit better than the general hospitals. And those are the ones where they can truly be nightmares, and seeing folks where they just don't know how to handle mental health problems when they're sitting there trying to triage physical health problems as quickly as possible. And, you know, just of no fault of their own, just triaging folks as they walk in, visually assessing what's there and moving on. You really can't do that for the mental health problems. So that's a bit unnerving and sad to hear that you still had that same type of situation in a behavioral hospital, when that would be something where folks are going to specifically for that. And you would think they would have a little bit more either control, compassion, or immersion into that space, and know that that's not entirely the case there.
I will fight ever having to go back there.
Okay.
It was not a good experience for me. You know, like I said, other than it kept me safe. Now, I'm sure I could have found a way to hurt myself, but it would have taken a lot of work, mm-hmm. which is part of the point of it all. But it was an expensive place to keep me safe.
And that's, again, the dichotomy there of going somewhere just to keep you safe versus a place where you're trying to basically symptom versus cause type thing. And so whether you're just trying to remove all possible problems or essentially help to create something that will in and of itself help to remove some of those problems naturally.
Yep.
And so it becomes a case of eventually in treating the symptom, you could be doing more harm than good type thing for some of the harshness and brashness with which those symptoms are treated in situations like that.
Yep. Yeah, so they did that. They put me back on meds. That was about all I got out of it. Now, they offered some classes and stuff, but anybody who had ever been through counseling already knew most of that information, because mm-hmm. it's fairly basic behavioral therapy stuff that, you know, you get taught along the way. So I did that. At the time, I'd only been at my job for just over three months. And so I was nervous about how they would respond to all of that. I basically just took the next 3 days off after I got out of the hospital and looked at my other options for going to an intensive outpatient program or whatnot, because I needed like something more.
Yeah, exactly. It's not something where you're going to leave that and just go back to work like nothing happened without any problems whatsoever.
Yeah, so I'd started doing short-term disability and stuff and working half days and going to the IOP, the intensive outpatient program. And sort of 2 weeks into that, realized that was sort of brain numbing enough that I wasn't effective at work for the half day I was there. And so I went on full-time medical leave for a couple of months and was at the IOP for about 8 weeks and definitely learned some new skills and some new things there. They changed my meds again. The biggest thing that I got out of sort of the hospital and going to the IOP is that I needed to improve my support network. Mm-hmm. So I had a lot of friends who I thought would be there who didn't know how to be. And that's not necessarily their fault, or it doesn't make them bad people or anything like that. It's just I was counting on some of the wrong people. And so I really sort of filtered down who my true support network was and then worked like I met some people and they shared some of their experiences and, you know, they've sort of become part of my support network. So I've done a lot to focus on building that community because that's having one or two people, they get sick of hearing every day that I suck, I'm struggling.
Yep. That's unfortunate.
You know, and they don't want to get sick of hearing it, but it's hard for them mm-hmm. because they care and there's not always something they can do. And so building that community has really helped me be able to spread out, sort of share the wealth of the yeah. crap with multiple people. And sometimes just getting different perspectives from different folks has been helpful. And, you know, sometimes one friend really is busy and can't come hang out and someone else can, and that's awesome. And so that community has been really, really important to me in the last almost year now to have built that up. And I feel lucky for some of the people who have come into my world in that time frame who have become part of that network. So that's been huge. But that being said, obviously I'm still in crisis mode. It's not an easy time for me to share my story, as mm-hmm. I mentioned, but it's no less important whether I'm in it or out of it. So I keep working at it, and I get frustrated because I learned all these new tools, and I've done so much work this year, and nothing seems to be helping, and it doesn't seem to be getting better. And, you know, that's been a frustration at times. But, you know, my counselor's been great about trying to come up with different ways to approach things and look at things and whatnot. So that's kind of where I'm at.
Well, I mean, first to just kind of recap that last section, I mean, you should really be proud of yourself for building that support community based off of how much of the introvert you explained yourself to be early on and where obviously, you know, even through your first bout or through some of the initial sharing of your story, you probably wouldn't have ever thought that was something you would electively go to and to try to build that and go outside of your shell a little bit. So that's a pretty big win there for establishing a better foundation, even though, you know, you still need to work with it. It's not something that is entirely, that should be easily overlooked. So you should give yourself a little bit of a credit for that, for being able to find and establish that a little bit more than something that was maybe there for the beginning of this round.
Thank you.
And then one other thing that I mentioned that kind of similar ties into that is the, if you want to, I mean, we can, depending on how deep you wanted to go there in your IOP program, you mentioned they kind of changed your meds. Was that something that was more prescribed to you, or did you have that's a similar level of conversation of the folks there to kind of have that with the meds there?
It was prescribed to me there. My regular psychiatrist was at least informed. And so I was in touch with him a couple of times just to make sure he was okay with these changes as well. You know, I sort of had to bridge that gap a little bit, mm-hmm. but you know, at least what was being just prescribed to me, I was given explanations of why
reasoning,
and
yeah.
why he thought it would be helpful or whatnot, which, you know, is important. So it's not like it was just dictated to me with no information. Mm-hmm. So they handled it well, but no, I didn't have quite as much choice as I had in the past. But I also knew it was temporary.
Yep.
Because I knew I'd go back to my other psychiatrist as soon as I got out of IOP. So
again, and looking at that as a tool to stabilize and move on is a good perspective to have there, as opposed to like you were saying there, you would know you would go back to your regular team and not be stuck with this setup here.
Yep.
the only other piece there about the IOP, was there a group aspect to the IOP in conversations with a number of other friends who have done similar programs? Those tend to have some of that component there. And so that I was wondering if how big of the group component there was in your IOP program, especially with your introvertedness being off the charts there.
Yeah, I mean, I was selective in who I chose to kind of, two things. One, take under my wing. We had some younger folks who seemed like their only adult influence was their parents, mm-hmm. and yet they were old enough they wanted to get away from that. They were okay. trying to move away from home and some of that. So there's a couple of kids that some of us kind of took under our wing and tried to help at the same time, which again is my coping mechanism for avoiding helping myself. But there were other folks there that I think there's five people I still keep in touch with okay. From that I really got to know and got comfortable with, and we check in on each other and know about each other's families or whatnot and things like that. So we know more than just IOP stuff. So we got to be pretty good friends. And some of it is just for me, for the introvert. Yeah. Initially I was like, nope, not talking to anybody. But I'm like, okay, you're missing out on an opportunity. Mm-hmm. Like, these people are here because we can all at some level relate to each other, even though the details may be different. And so, you know, as you start to sit by the same people over and over and stuff, you just naturally start to say hello and talk to people. And, you know, I'm good one-on-one. I just don't want to talk to the whole room at the same time. Yep. So yeah, so I've walked away with folks that I still keep in touch with there.
That's good to hear.
Yeah.
And it's very similar to the metaphor that came to mind when you were saying that. Almost felt like when you put two babies in a playpen, they're kind of forced to eventually interact. So yep. that was something there where you may be have blinders on and very focused on whatever it is at hand and kind of tuning everyone else out. But when you're in that situation, it kind of, that's more work than the interaction and then talking and eventually some of those connections. So it does tend to be serendipitous how that happens. And you can, even though you're kind of fighting your own tendencies, it tends to be better in the long run once you are kind of going against yourself almost.
Yep.
So you mentioned, I mean, there's a lot there, and thanks for going into the detail that you did there for your second round and the fact that you still are in crisis mode. But what is something now that is keeping you going and that you're working on day to day, as far as day in, day out, long-term goals or anything like that? Or you mentioned a purpose, finding one, versus some of the transitionality ideas, and what are you currently working on now to kind of keep that going?
Yeah, so I mean, a lot of what keeps me going is my community. You know, when it comes to the suicidal thoughts and things like that, I know there's a lot of people who would be pissed off and hurt mm-hmm. and everything else if I ended my life, and they've invested a lot, and so a lot of times I feel like I owe it to them to keep fighting. I owe it to them to you know, build on their hope. I think the other thing is that I went to school to be a high school English teacher and never really did that. But the reason I wanted to be a high school English teacher was because I wanted to help kids.
Okay.
And so same reason I coach soccer. I mean, it's not the only reason, but it's part of it. Kids like me who had nowhere to go. And so there's always been this desire to help people beyond just escaping my own stuff. You know, it's bigger than that. My counselor quite often has said, I'm pretty convinced based on what you've said that your purpose in life is to serve others. Mm-hmm. I have another group of folks that's more religiously affiliated that has said the same thing. So I keep getting this message that this is what you're meant to do. And I wholeheartedly agree. I just don't always know how to make it happen.
Exactly.
And so I'm working on that. But that's a big part of what brought me to Heart Camp last year, is that, you know, I have these ideas and you know, I know at some level what I'm after, but I don't know how to get there. So my thought was, you know, I'm not quite in transition, but I'm looking to get there.
Yep.
And thought I might meet some folks who would have some ideas or even potentially some folks to team up with to try to do something. You know, there's lots of organizations out there that help people, and I tend to lean towards kids just because I think there's a gap there sometimes. There's this expectation that their family and parents can help them, and that's not always the case. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that comes from my own experience, but I've also witnessed it in many other places. But I'm not dead set on it needing to be kids. There are times that, yeah, it makes sense that it would relate to mental health since that's just part of who I am. But, you know, if I find an opportunity to go build ways for people in South Africa to have clean water, I'm not opposed to that either.
Exactly. So
I really haven't formalized what I'm trying to do. And so I was really hoping at Heart Camp to get some inspiration and maybe some ideas and things like that. I didn't necessarily get that, but I got a lot of other great things out of Heart Camp. Again, building the community, made a couple of really good friends that I keep in touch with on a fairly regular basis, which has been awesome. You know, getting to meet Jamie and actually, you know, have some time with him was phenomenal. I mean, I guess I've met him before, but to actually be able to have a conversation with him was
which is exactly cool. What he said, like, the purpose of Heart Camp to be to turn those initial conversations that he would have at shows and speaking engagements, yep, and things like that for a couple of minutes into, you know, much longer and more involved and having those conversations and being in the moment there as opposed to having it be on a stopwatch. So those are some of, yep, the kind of the serendipitous moments there too.
Yeah. I mean, it was cool. A lot of the guest speakers were great. They're, you know, for me, because I was in crisis at that time too, I went telling myself to not put my game face on, but I ended up putting my, mm-hmm, game face on. So I didn't get as much out of it as I probably could have. I hit a lot of things from a lot of people. It just was too raw to get into. Because actually the day after I got back is the day I got hospitalized.
Okay.
Certainly nothing to do with Heart Camp. The Heart Camp weekend itself was great. It was an escape. I felt so much better than I had. It was the minute it ended, I hit this wall of going, but nothing changed. I go back to the exact, mm-hmm, same thing. You know, so that was a tough realization moment. That wasn't what I had expected. So, you know, looking forward to going to the Heart Camp reunion and, you know, in my time of chaos, if Heart Camp's just a weekend of an escape, then that's awesome. You know, I'll get to meet some additional people and see some old friends and, you know, hear some new stuff and see Jamie, and it's just going to be a good weekend. So I don't often say I have good weekends, so I'm looking forward to that.
And that's the one of the other topics we generally talk about a decent amount here is self-care, and you hit the nail right on the head there where, I mean, that seems like it would be something that the robustness of the whole experience of having to travel, getting away, going there, immersing yourself, circling back with friends you met during your session, new friends from potentially other sessions that are coming back, the new speakers, turning speakers, things like that, that ends up being something where that's the penultimate definition of self-care there, where,
yep,
again, it's not something that is going to be a panacea for anything, but it is something where, or, you know, cure all, et cetera, but it is something that you're going to be able to apply and work with through your time of, be it crisis, be it searching, be it, you know, transition period, et cetera, but just trying to understand what that is and what the drive and what you need to keep going. That can just be a moment in time along that journey too. So it yep, is something where it's could be many things, and the what you need out of it now could be completely different than what you needed out of it last year. And I don't think we had the conversation yet, but which session did you go to originally?
The February session.
Okay. That's what, yeah, I thought, but I wasn't sure. And so, I mean, having that type of experience then, and then again, that would be no fault to yours as far as coming home and knowing that you needed more help coming out of that, because to me, that would almost kind of make sense knowing that what you were going through at home wasn't right and you needed more help than what you currently had. So speaking up is even more power to it to be able to get through it so that you're now still here to be able to kind of make it to the reunion. And so that's grateful that you were able to see that you needed more help and grew through some of that experience since then to know that you're may still be in crisis, but you're still here and still moving forward is a long step too.
Yeah, another year.
And it's interesting that you mentioned wanting to be a high school English teacher to help kids, because I have no idea if she listens to this podcast, even though I share it on Facebook and everything else. But out of whenever I think of high school teachers or teachers, or whenever anybody says teachers that have, you know, influenced me, it's always been one key high school English teacher. And that may be because that was one of the ones that challenged me the most, but also one of the ones that was also a, she treated us like adults as opposed to either students or kids or anything like that. And know that we were capable of handling concepts that were much bigger than us and putting things in context. And it also helped that she was a sports fan of all the same sports teams that I was. So that worked well too. So nice. We could talk there, especially being a big hockey fan. But it's always interesting where, you know, those impacts where whatever the reason that they got into it for whatever reason, there are many different audiences that can take away many different kind of aspects of the same act of service that they're performing. So the fact that you're, again, as it was noted, your calling is to help people is one that is very common, and you're kind of in a common position of, I know what I want to do, or I know like what the sentiment is behind it, but I just don't know how to make it happen. And so I think as time progresses, we'll see more of that conversation happening as far as to get the ball rolling and get that kind of sentiment snowballing with more of the Hartkamp family and bringing some other folks in to the conversation and kind of as it grows to see other folks, because there are a number of folks in the Hartkamp family who were previously doing things and previously had started things, going in looking for some of exactly what you were to try to expand some of their initial mission. There's been a number of things that have launched since then, you know, not only the Hartkamp being the genesis of this podcast, but a number of other podcasts that have come out of folks going to Hartkamp and knowing that's what they have the vision that they want to put to their voice, and then having their existing story and wanting to help share that with other folks as well. So it's something where the timing and kind of the intersection and the overlapping of the sine waves for your day-to-day journey and then kind of what you're striving to is something that to keep marching towards and not lose sight of. But it's something where I think eventually, as you keep having that conversation going and keep breaking that stigma and keep telling your story, it's one where eventually the negative space between those two will decrease and they'll overlap and it'll become one and the same, and you'll find that and have that spark of ignition in your brain to figure out what exactly is you want to do and be able to run with it that way.
Yeah. I would agree with that. You know, now I work in IT and I just don't, you know, sure, what I do matters to a handful of users, but that's about it. And that just doesn't quite fulfill it. So
as someone who was also in IT, I completely agree with you. So you're definitely not alone in that camp. So that is one where this is why it's also a passion project, because again, that's not really, changing many lives, I should say, during the 9 to 5 currently. So trying to figure that out and move somewhere in addition to that is a big goal of mine as well. So I'm right there with you on that one.
Cool.
One of the two questions we've asked every episode is, what is one thing that you'd want someone to take away from your story? Is that something you would want to distill down into that simple question and answer? Or I'll just say, is there something that you'd want to distill down for that answer?
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's several things that come to mind, but I would probably say just share your story. That's probably the biggest thing that I think you can do to help yourself and help others.
Excellent. And that is one that is so powerful in its succinctness. And that's one that we generally end up overloading with words, but yeah, just sharing your story is the most powerful one. And then the only other question that we do on every episode is a song for every episode from the guest. So is that one that is there a song that you'd want to share or add to the seasonal playlist for one that you just love, or is a self-care song, or is one that is a literally or lyrically tells your story?
Yeah, that one's tough for me because I tend to listen to just songs that resonate with me for various reasons. Mm-hmm. And since I've spent enough time in depression, a lot of them are not the most uplifting songs, but I'll give it a go with, depending on how you take the lyrics, but Take You Home by Scars on 45.
That is one that I do not know of. You said Scars on 45?
Yeah.
But I will look them up. And again, there's been a number of times where folks have had the same sentiment and then they've said the lyrics and they take it one way. And I'm kind of a music and lyric nerd. And so I may take it a completely different way. And then they're like, oh, that's a good way too. So we'll definitely look those up. And regardless of what's there, a lot of the initial responses from folks are, well, yeah, I just generally like sad songs or depressive songs or kind of reassuring songs while I'm in that state. So those are exactly the type of songs we want to share too, because folks want to hear those as well. And so that's not a problem at all.
Yeah, Mad World on the Donnie Darko soundtrack.
Well, excellent. That I mean, that'll wrap it up from my end. And so was there anything else you wanted to cover before we kind of call it a day?
No, thanks. I think we're good. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so very much for joining us this week. We hope you had as good a time listening as we had recording the interview. Don't forget to check out anthologiesofhope.com/playlist for all the awesome songs that will get added each week. You can find us on social media at Anthologies of Hope on Facebook and Instagram, and Anthologies Pod on Twitter. It would be great if you could subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or Google, and leave us a review. As always, remember, everyone has a story, and it's about time we start listening.